Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Red Pill Blue Blood podcast. I was very happy to be able to get the chance to sit down with my fellow BYU Conservatives Instagram page admin, Tommy Stevenson, and discuss with him some of the things that we have been up to, the things that we see at BYU, and a lot of tangents along the way. Before we get into that, as always, I really appreciate it when you share, when you give reviews, and when you interact with our posts about these podcasts. Without further ado, let's get into it. I'm Luke Hansen, and this is Red Pill Blue Blood. All right, so today I am here with my fellow BYU Conservatives admin guy, Tommy Stevenson. Tommy, welcome.
Nice to be here. Good to be here, Luke.
With the Bybee issue, was kind of the first time that we talked together and said, you know, the page has been anonymous for a while. Maybe we should introduce ourselves. And so now here we are continuing that and doing a podcast together to introduce ourselves a little bit. So do you want to give some background on yourself, Tommy?
Yeah, of course. So originally I'm from upstate New York. I served a mission in Orem, Utah, believe it or not. When I got the call, I thought it was something of a joke, but it turned out to be a really good experience. I have a lot of good connections in Utah because of it. Came out to school in Utah. I'm doing public relations. I started as an undergrad for pre-business, switched to PR because I wanted to go into politics, but now I'm doing PR, business strategy minor, and a psychology minor because I wanted to go into organizational behavior and then go into politics at some point. Yeah. Officially go into politics, maybe just dabble a little bit before then.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. And I've actually never introduced myself formally on this podcast either. So I am, of course, Luke Hansen, and I am a chemical engineering major here at BYU. And I grew up in California, the Central Valley area. But yeah, here at BYU, chemical engineering is not really a political thing. I've never heard... Almost never heard anybody talk politics.
Public relations is really political.
Yeah, it's just homework, basically all the time. So a question people, I think, had about both of us was, how did we get involved in politics? So, Tommy, how did you...
So New York tends to lean left a lot. It's mostly, it's kind of centered in New York City and concentrated there, but there are some pockets in upstate New York. Upstate's mostly conservative. I happen to be in a pocket that was more liberal. And because of that, my school, like we had a cultural diversity tree one year for Christmas. So it was that politically correct. But because of that, I always had to defend myself, and I tend to be a disagreeable person. One of the next questions is influencers on us politically, and one of them is Jordan Peterson. So I've kind of analyzed my own personality traits, and I'm pretty disagreeable. And because of that, I don't like to get pushed around, I guess. And so when people said things like, oh, you're racist, oh, you're sexist, you're a homophobe, I had to be able to come back to them with things that were a little bit more intellectually based, instead of just saying, no, you're wrong. I'm not a racist. I'm not a sexist. It had to be a little bit more empirical. And because of that, I did a lot of studying of politics in high school. I wrote articles for the school newspaper. And then I went on the mission, but wasn't involved in politics that much there. And you can't really be. But then I kind of hopped back into politics at BYU, going to the College Republicans Club, going to a few things, and then ultimately landing with BYU Conservatives.
Would you say that it was the people that were pushing back against you that was the main motivation for you developing your views further?
I think it was freshman year of high school. Like you said, when people were pushing back, it started to develop my views further and refine them, I would say. I wouldn't say it pushed me in any specific direction, but I just had to be a little bit more articulate with them, and I had to be more specific in what I studied and how I could combat the different viewpoints that they would bring up.
Mm-hmm. Were people in high school that knowledgeable?
No. No, okay. I wouldn't say. I would say very few people in high school were that knowledgeable. Mm-hmm. I don't think I was that knowledgeable either. I mean, I think that's where it stems from, but I don't think by any stretch of the imagination I was highly intellectual by my senior year. I mean, I listened to a lot of podcasts, but I didn't really read that many books on politics until after high school and when I was in college.
Yeah, I didn't read any books until fairly recently. Being from California, you would think that I was in a fairly liberal place, but being in the Central Valley area, it's a lot of farming, kind of small towns type of thing going on. And so it's actually pretty conservative. As far as my high school went, there wasn't that much politic stuff in it. It wasn't too much. So I wouldn't say that I didn't feel the need to develop my views that much and get a lot extra information while I was in high school. That was more afterwards. So how much would you say that you know about politics and your political views? How informed would you rate yourself?
I would weigh myself as above average. I wouldn't say I'm an expert on stuff. Well, I guess it would depend on the topic, because with some policies, I don't know. Like on foreign policy, my viewpoint on that is to take it on a case-by-case basis, I would say. Mm-hmm. I'm not isolationist, but I don't think we should do stuff like nation building. But also, I don't think that you can just do what we did in Afghanistan and pull out without any support. Because the only reason South Korea is still South Korea is because we left troops there. Yeah, I would say I'm above average informed on various topics. Some topics, not as much as others. On identity politics, and because I think identity politics is poison, mm-hmm. and that's the thing that I want to combat the most out of everything. I think I've studied that the most, like race and gender issues, that type of thing. And I think that specifically that topic is just poisonous to our society in general. Out of everything that I've studied, I think I've studied and gone over those types of things the most.
Yeah, I would say that is very much where I am. Like some foreign policy things is like, does anybody know? And I haven't looked into it too much, although I've tried to pick up some things here and there. And things like what you normally hear in politics, things like taxes and that kind of stuff. Obviously, I'm for smaller government, done some looking into the Constitution. But mostly as far as research, statistics, facts that I can pull up and talk about would be abortion, race, and gender. Mm-hmm. Those kind of more cultural war issues. I should also add in that I'm definitely above average on global warming. I don't think really anybody's an expert on that because
Lundberg is really expert on that. Have you listened to some of his podcasts?
I have.
Bjorn Lundberg with Peterson. He's really good.
With Peterson?
Yeah.
If it was with Peterson, I might have.
Yeah. He's been interviewed by Peterson a couple of times, but Bjorn Lundberg, I can't remember which institution he works for, but basically his view, he's done a lot of research on what would happen if we did stop producing CO2. Mm-hmm. And versus if we didn't. Mm-hmm. And you have to weigh. It's like economics. There's no solution.
Yeah.
There's only
cost benefit.
There's only cost and benefit. If we were to stop all oil production, all carbon emissions right now, we would destroy the GDP of the world, but we would only lower the temperature by like a half a degree in 100 years, something like that.
Yeah, because the carbon dioxide has about a 100 year residence time in the atmosphere when it's released from ground level. Yeah. And also being a chemical engineer, I knew that CO2 had an IR emission spectra and only can absorb certain wavelengths, and that's what leads to the greenhouse effect. Like, I kind of knew these things and I have an engineering sense of what you want to look at when you're talking about this stuff. So that kind of gives me an edge in that spot. But yeah, we don't know everything, but probably above average in a couple of places. Although I guess that's not saying much considering Twitter. But what would you say about something like history or American history? How do you feel about that?
I'm pretty good on American history. I would need to brush up on stuff in order to get a really... I mean, I can tell you generally when things happened, But I would need to brush up to be able to tell you specific things on years and those types of things.
If somebody was going to try to take you through, like, the history of America and paint it as a history of oppression, would you be able to point out
things? I would be able to point out the specific points where there was oppression and generally where there wasn't oppression.
Where is a category that you would like to learn more about?
I'm reading 12 Rules for Life again while I'm listening to it. And I wanted, because I specifically wanted to hear Peterson read about it. So I haven't been reading anything political as of right now. Also, I'm doing a lot of finance books, like just personal finance. I've gotten a lot into passive income, those types of things, because there's been a lot of talk in politics about how unnecessary college is. And even though I'm probably going to go do a master's degree, at this point, sometimes I'm just say, you know, school right now is just getting in the way of what I want to do. But I do also understand that it's a good plan to have a degree as well. I'm not saying that you should quit school, but if you're a gender studies major, maybe you could you should consider quitting school or just switching majors.
I don't think they have that at BYU.
We have women's studies.
Yeah. Is that a major or just a class? It might be a major.
Yeah.
It's probably at least a minor. Yeah, college, it needs a overhaul.
Yeah. I think basically all the humanities degrees need an overhaul. They need to bring it back from social justice and all this grievance paper or grievance oppression type stuff and bring it back to philosophy. Like, I took a history of psychology class and it was amazing. Like, we talked about Socrates and Aristotle and how it applies to psychology. And then we talked about Carl Jung and all these different people, how Western ideals kind of led to the realm of psychology. Because there's a few different philosophers who are also psychologists, like Carl Jung. And
philosophy necessarily is part psychology, if you're not officially a psychologist.
Because basically when you're trying to understand people, you're trying to understand their moral value system as well, and also how that develops over time. Mm-hmm. And so, say in the West, it's based on Christianity. Like, that's at the base. And it wasn't Nietzsche or Carl Jung. I can't remember. It's one of them who announced the death of God.
That was Nietzsche.
It was Nietzsche.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he said that basically with a scientific revolution, that God would be taken out of the picture and we'd go to either nihilism or totalitarianism. And that's what happened with the 20th century. That was one class that had the subject of humanities that I was very interested in, because I think the professor knew a lot and he knew what he was talking about. But I think that some humanities, like I took a sociology class. It was kind of for fun, not gonna lie.
And is this just like basic sociology?
It was current social problems. It was It was the one with Lopez. The one that I got that we posted the assignment from. It was that class, but I never had that assignment. I was just in that class over 2 years ago. You have to fulfill a GE, I think, with it. So I took that class. I kind of took it because I wanted to get back into politics after the mission and get a refresher. So why not go into a really liberal class and get a refresher on politics and have to defend myself, I guess, and defend my views. So I think that a lot of the, like, sociology, there's problems with the psychology department. I wouldn't say you should get rid of psychology, because psychology actually is useful. But some parts of it, I'm just, why are we talking about gender theory right now? Stuff like that, or race-based mental health. It's like, stuff like that.
Race-based mental health.
Yeah.
Oh, that's
I haven't gone into that. It's only a minor, so I've only been introduced to some of the topics that are in the minor.
Race-based mental health is a minor?
No. Oh. So, like, that's a topic in a class.
Got it.
That's also part of the major or minor. Mm-hmm. Like, we talked about differences in mental health between people of different races, which, I mean, I can understand why people...
Black women are 2 times more likely to say that they are beautiful than white women. That's probably not a stat that's talked about in that class.
I've never heard that.
Because it was actually the Committee on Race, Equity, and Belonging report that really propelled me to start this podcast and also do a lot of research. Mm-hmm. And looking through stuff, you start to see some interesting, and that's one of them. And it's been verified in a couple different places.
Wow.
And it holds true for young, like teenage, up through older as well.
It probably has to do with social pressures and stuff like that, or social pressures, environmental factors, that kind of thing. Just because ultimately race doesn't mean anything, but when your culture is constantly telling you that race means this, race means that, race means this,
yeah,
it can have an effect on your mental health or your mental well-being.
Yeah,
and just the ideas that you have.
There's kind of like a nature versus nurture problem, mm-hmm. especially in polling that just asks people how they feel about stuff. Because, yeah, like if you asked Americans, how rich do you think you are, or how wealthy do you feel, the answers would almost certainly vary quite a lot from where they actually fall on like the world scale of how wealthy people are, or all of history, all people scale of how wealthy they are.
And all of history, we're all in the top 1%.
Yeah.
If you're in America. And basically, if you have over $20,000, you're in the top 1% in the world just right now. In terms of history, you're probably the top point. I don't know the statistic specifically, but you're probably in the top 0.1% of all time.
Yeah.
Because we talked about this in my sociology, the current social problems class. People just, I guess, I brought this up that people are complaining so much about different things that we have today. It's like, oh, there's races and there's sexes and there's all this stuff. I'm saying, you know, 100 years ago, you didn't have toilets like in your house. And you had, mm-hmm. and there was probably sewage running in the streets and stuff like that. And I'm just saying, you all are all, like, I think that there should be a manner in which we talk about how things can improve. There's a place for that. But there's also a place for how about gratitude for the things that we have right now.
Because you've got to keep it in context.
You have to keep it in context, because 200 years ago, 300 years ago, I mean, we'd be lucky to be alive right now.
Mm-hmm.
And you probably don't live past 35, 40 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Like at all.
Yeah.
It's just amazing to me how people forget things in the past so easily. And that's also true with politics, like Marxism and stuff, and what the effects of that has.
There was an article just today or yesterday in the Daily Universe, the BYU paper. So we're talking mm-hmm. local stuff here. And it was talking about the outrage that certain birth controls apparently are not covered by the insurance agency that covers church employees mm-hmm. and BYU students. So like, oh yeah, I had this medical examination and my uterus, there was some problem with it and I needed to get an IUD, but it wasn't covered. So it's $1,300. And it's like, oh no, oh no, no. It's like, well, I'm not like saying, oh, it's good that they're not covering this or anything like yeah. that. It's just like taking a step back and like, if this is a very necessary medical thing that's going to do you a lot of good, is it worth $1,300 out of your pocket? Probably.
Yeah.
Was that something available to people, your grandmother? I don't think so.
I mean, tampons weren't available 200-ish years ago.
It's like, yeah.
I hate the whole, I guess this is a tangent, but the theory.
We're just going like Joe Rogan style here.
Yeah.
We're just
like the theory that men just oppressed women for all of time up until, say, well, they say we still oppress them. And I guess, and there is still oppression and discrimination. Mm-hmm. But I think that applies to both sexes. But in individual instances, men would certainly overpower women for the most part on average, because just in terms of biological strength, men are, they're stronger. But the way to look at looking at history in that way, it's like, that's not, I mean, oppression definitely happened. But also, tampons didn't exist up until like the mid-1900s, basically,
mm-hmm.
or
I can't, it's probably the earlier mid-1900s. So that's probably why women were confined to the home and not because men said, you should go work on the laundry and take care of the kids. It's probably because you wouldn't want to be having your period out in the field or having, and also there was no birth control. So if you're pregnant, and since there's no birth control, there's a very high likelihood that you get pregnant. That's probably a bigger reason why you were confined at the home than the oppression of men, just in general.
And yeah. I mean, it says, because the problem is history is so big that you can find multiple examples of whatever side it is that you want to support. Yeah. But you do have to look at, like, okay, where does this thinking lead us? Because some ideas are just wrong. Like, the world is flat is a popular one that people throw around. But then there are some ideas that are popular in the sense that people like to talk about it as a bad idea a lot.
In the past.
I personally haven't met anybody that's like that. But there are some ideas that are bad. And then there are some ideas that are pernicious. And I think this concept of anything that goes back to Marx, not necessarily is wrong, but you need to look at it more carefully.
Marx and the French Revolution.
And a history can be summed up as men oppressing women is not only wrong, it's pernicious.
Yeah. I think it's pernicious because it just, what are you supposed to do with that as a guy? You're just supposed to say, oh, I'm just a terrible person because I was born as a male.
And what are you supposed to do at it?
I was assigned male at birth, is what the terminology is. But I, but it's like, what are you supposed to do with that? Like, men have, I think, liberal men, according to stats, have the worst mental health, I believe, or they report the most. This isn't this probably isn't including COVID, because mental health problems just happen a lot, but. If you're constantly told you're just an oppressor and masculinity is toxic, what are you supposed to do with yourself? And what purpose are you supposed to find in ambition? Because I think that that's just so damaging. And you should, I mean, you should definitely have a balance where you talk about things that have happened to women and sexism in the past and in the present. But you should also say, but hey, kid, you should go do something with your life. And I think Peterson does a good job of doing that, because he's just, I can't believe that people, I mean, I can't believe it, but just as a general rule, I can't believe people just call him a sexist and a racist. And it's like, people offhand. Walk just offhand. And he has people walk up to him like four times an hour to ask him, or not to ask him, but to thank him for helping them in their life. And it's usually men. And it's because he's encouraging them in a specific way that helps them to realize, oh, I should be ambitious, but it should be done in the right way. And I should be masculine, but it's not toxic. Like, masculinity isn't toxic. That usually happens when you don't express your masculine traits in the proper way, because they just get covered up, and then eventually they explode in the wrong way.
There's some people that like to use the phrase toxic masculinity a lot.
Yes.
And then, of course, the comment will always come up, oh, men aren't toxic, war on men, all that kind of stuff. And then the response is always, oh, no, we're just saying that the expression that men can have sometimes and that society tells them is good, they usually throw that in there. And what society tells men is good is hurtful both to women and even more so to themselves. So it's like a loving term that we put. It's like, okay, fair enough to all of that. But is there a toxic femininity thing?
There is definitely toxic femininity.
It's like, so why don't we talk about it? Why aren't there words along with that? Well, and they're like, well, no, girls have problems too. It's like, yeah, but the fact that there's a phrase that everybody throws around called toxic masculinity, and there's nothing on the other side. Or any equivalent phrase means that we must be viewing men, people who adopt these worldviews must be viewing men as a larger problem than women. And you can like explain and explain and explain and explain, but just the fact that that phrase exists in the culture and the opposite phrase doesn't exist for women gives the game away.
Yeah. And it's just like, it's just because you're saying at that point, it's just half the human race is the problem and not the other half. And it's like, there's like, you can have overly toxic men or not masculine. Well, yes, masculine, but also feminine traits. Because I think it was Christofferson that talked about this in a devotional a few weeks ago. And he said, being overly compassionate is not Christ-like. Mm-hmm. Because when you have too much compassion, you're not pushing people to do their best. You're just saying you're good as you are and you don't have to change anything, which isn't true for anybody except Christ. But you have to, like, in order to get the best out of people, and this can apply to parenting. Mm-hmm. It's like, you have to accept your kid as they are and love them, but also when they go, say, I don't know, crash their car when they're a teenager, you should probably do something about that that isn't compassionate. Like, or like, don't let them have a car, or enforce some kind of disciplinary action, because people have to learn in order to progress, and everyone needs to progress or else you're just going to stay the same. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think that's a big thing that the right should, I think that's a big message that the right should focus on, but I don't think they focus on it enough. I think Peterson does a good job at it, but I think that taking responsibility for yourself and self-improvement is a good message that the right should embrace and kind of use that. And speaking as a PR major, I guess, the right is bad at PR.
Yes. I don't think that's a controversial statement.
The right is bad at PR, and it's, they have to find, like, I think that the messaging of getting CRT to be an issue on the platform and getting, I think that the worst mistake from the left has been to make parents a voting block now.
Yes.
Like, are you, like, did you really want to do that? And like with Governor Youngkin and McAuliffe in Virginia, because McAuliffe just said, he basically said that schools teach your children, not you.
Yeah. It's kind of a slip up. He tried to take it back pretty quickly afterwards. Yeah.
I know. It's like you said the quiet part out loud at that point, and the cat's out of the bag. And then you just had a bunch of parents basically rise up against you.
Well, the right finally did a bit of good branding just recently. Mm-hmm. Because people have been saying, oh, the trans rights and the healthcare and the basic human decency and all that stuff is out the window because of DeSantis and these different laws and trans things and whatever it is that they're crying about. And the new phrase is, okay, groomer. It's like, that's perfect. That's absolutely perfect. Like, we finally had some sort of branding that is effective.
I mean,
and I'm not like a big fan. Bumper stickers should not be your full argument.
No.
If you're on the right and the only thing you can say is okay, groomer, then like go read some stuff.
Yeah.
And if you're on the left and the only thing you can say is something, something empathy, like, or Black Lives Matter, go read some stuff.
Yeah. I hate the.
But the bumper stickers are still important.
Oh, yeah.
For branding, pop culture, because Twitter's not real life, but things do happen there.
Yeah.
Or on Instagram. And we can't just, once you take a little segment and say, no, we'll just give that to the other side, we'll give that W to them and just fight everything else. It's like, okay, well, they're going to take the W and then they're going to come and fight you on the other things with the power that the institutions that you left behind give them.
And that's what the left has done, I think, for the past 50 or so years. Because every policy move, basically every major policy change, has been from the left for the last 50 years. Mm-hmm. Like, they have shifted. It's not the right that's shifting the center. It's the left. And you can see that with people accepting, I guess, being more accepting of gay marriage or transgender issues. And also, I know right after the George Floyd, one and a half George Floyd happened, the support for BLM went way up. But then it plummeted right after the summer when there was a lot of rioting. There were so many donations. But it's just, it's amazing to see that the left has come this far, I guess. Like 10 years ago, I would have never heard anything, anyone saying boys can be girls and girls can be boys. Mm-hmm. Like I didn't hear anything like that. I didn't see anything like that. But now that's almost mainstream.
That's not the terms that they put it in.
I mean,
they try to, but yeah, they do. I want to go back to this like overly compassionate thing, mm-hmm. especially the fact that Detod Christofferson touched on it.
Yeah.
I think is important because this kind of brings it more local to BYU and the church. In the church, and I think in the world, people might say, oh, men are accepted for being toxically masculine, the culture. It's like, I don't think that's actually true to that extent. If you hear the complaint that men are toxic and in their masculinity more than you see the toxic masculinity, that probably means society's not in favor of the toxic masculinity because you're hearing the opposite more than you're actually seeing it. But we're both in the church and in society on the problems that men can have. Mm-hmm. But if we're going to take it as, okay, we're all children of God and women are great, but they're not superheroes. So if there are things that Satan and society can do to men to hijack their natural inclinations towards protection, that can be turned into violence, or a sex drive can be turned into addictive behaviors like pornography, we're very aware for that for men. Mm-hmm. Doesn't it logically make sense that there must be something for women that their natural inclinations can get hijacked by society and Satan and go off on a bad direction? Yeah, and what are those? Yeah. We've kind of hinted at it, but I think it's this overly compassionate.
It's overly compassionate. It's you're fine the way you are. I mean, that's traditionally feminine traits, but I mean, there's women who aren't traditionally.
Yeah, we're talking bell curves here.
Bell curves and distributions. In terms of just traits in general or cultural values, I think that if you were to make a scale on, say, a scale of the two principles of you're fine the way you are, you need to improve. I think the society has tipped too far to the you're fine the way you are side.
And I think that's driven mostly by females.
Yeah.
That push. You can go on Instagram and anytime at girls all over the place, people like Julie Hanks. I'm not going to call her Dr. Julie Hanks. It's just Julie Hanks. Or you can see it with like other
just like the
mid-sized
feminist movement in general.
I just saw an quote unquote influencer video maker says she's a member of the church. 3/4 of her pictures are selfies, and half of those are her in a bikini. And then she puts this post out like, "Oh, people were telling me about modesty and trying to shame me and all that stuff." But like, and then it was just the typical normal blah blah blah. You do you, great the way you are, God loves you, personal relationship, figure it out for yourself, you get to decide stuff. And she's like, oh no, I'm being attacked by all these people. And I'm not saying she hasn't been, but that post got twice as many likes as anything else, tons of comments, the clappy hands, the hearts, the love this, the OMG, I needed this right now, you know?
I literally hate the clappy hands.
Don't you ever put clappy hands on our posts, the BYU conservatives. No, I'm joking.
Okay, you can put clappy hands on there, but just know that I don't like it. You don't make your point go across any more effectively by clapping.
But if like society is trying to be really repressive to you and judge you all the time and stuff, then why is your Instagram post that complains about that the one that gets twice as many likes as everything else?
I think it's just the way the culture is right now. Like if the scale thing, I guess, if you were to go back to it, we're just too far on the you are fine the way you are side.
But people are pretending like we're too far. Way too far on the judge side.
The judge
side. Like, people judge each other all of the time. It's ridiculous. It's everywhere. Oh, and then this post of me complaining about it gets twice as many likes as everything else. Whoops, how did that happen? My judgment of society still holds true, though. Don't believe otherwise.
I know. No, it's...
But we see that in the church. I mean, there's a massive...
I see it in the church, too. No, I think it's less in the church because if you go to different universities, I don't know what the stats are right now, but I think it's around 60% right now is female in universities and 40% male. And I know that prior to probably the 1980s, 90s that was skewed way more towards male, like 70-80%. I don't know exactly the numbers, but just as because of the birth control pill and different and this second wave feminist movement, I would say that got more women into higher education. But you can just see the effect that men are, the effect that this, the whole culture is having on men. And I think it's that you're fine the way you are. Like, to quote Peterson, it's like, there's nothing worse you can say to someone than that, basically. It's like, you have all these problems and you know you have all these problems. And then someone says, oh, don't worry, you're fine the way you are. It's like, no, like, tell me something wrong that I'm doing that I can fix. And because you have to have a purpose. I guess I'll disclose this on the podcast because I have to disclose this personally. But last year I had a thyroid issue that basically made me have depression. And it took away my sense of motivation and my sense of purpose. And naturally you can fall into depression because you don't feel like you have a sense of purpose. Like that's why people get that's why a lot of people do get depressed, is because they feel like they don't have direction. They're not, they don't feel like they have a purpose or have something to do. And I was way in the opposite direction. Like I always wanted to do something. I always wanted to work. But then just experiencing that while also, because I still got two promotions at work while that happened. And it was mostly because of discipline and possibly, and I still went to the gym mostly. That was probably because I was able to take pre-workout without much effort. And once you take pre-workout, you want to go work out. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. Because you just, I don't know who is taking it online, but your skin tingles and you just feel like you need to go do something.
This is totally out of my wheelhouse, so I'll just kind of nod. Okay.
So, but when you do, when I did work or when I did things, it helped. Because if you just lie in bed all day, that doesn't help you. Like, I've heard a lot of people talk about mental health days or taking off because you're just not feeling things and you need to take a break.
What do you think about that?
I think that there are scenarios in which you should take a day off. Like if you're having, I mean, I didn't have anxiety. It was just, it was like depression with brain fog and I couldn't feel emotion. Like, and I couldn't feel purpose basically 90-80% of the time. But I think it can be debilitating, anxiety more so than depression, because depression, you're just like, well, I guess it's different for different people. And my experience was I just don't feel anything. And I could sit here and you could talk to me and I would register some of it, but also wouldn't. You don't know what meaningfulness feels like until you can't feel it, is what I have brought into what I've devised from that. And you have to feel, if you feel like you don't have a purpose because you're told you don't have a purpose, or you're told things that make you feel like you don't have a purpose, then your brain develops that pathway and you don't feel like you should do things. And that can fall into depression, like clinical depression. And that's what I experienced. And it's terrible. It's like, there were instances where I felt like, hey, I don't really care what happens to me right now. And I'm just walking down the street. Like, because you don't care about anything. Because nothing just registers. And I think that people need to be told that they have a purpose and told that, because people finding their own purpose is very complicated. There's just too many choices. You have to have some direction. Like, I think that's why moral structures and avenues and commandments, what have you, exist, so that you can find out what you need to do and then do it in the proper way and not feel and not be a bad person, basically. And that's why the commandments, moral structures, everything developed over centuries. Mm-hmm. Because we had to figure it out, basically. Like, I don't know what, I can't remember. There's some studies about animals, but they act out moral codes somewhat.
If there are two monkeys in a cage on either side of each other and they are doing some sort of task, I believe it's they're giving you a rock. Mm-hmm. Then you give them, I think it was a nut. Uh-huh. Give them a nut, give you the rock, you give them the nut. But then the monkey on one side, because there's two of them, when he gives the researcher a rock, the researcher starts giving him like a very nice piece of fruit instead of the nut. And the other monkey sees that and starts like, what the heck? And he starts giving the rock to the researcher. The researcher keeps giving him the nut and eventually just freaks out and is like, no, I'm not doing this. This is ridiculous. Like, that's a...
that's like primordial ethics.
Yeah.
Like, what? I guess.
Which, if you brought it forward to the 21st century, you might call judging.
Yeah.
Because the monkey, and I don't... We have so few answers, I don't want to get into like this whole evolution rabbit hole with the church and stuff. But let's just say the way evolutionary science stands right now, we can learn a lot of stuff from it. And there's a lot of truths that come out of it. But okay, so the monkey.
Yes.
I just don't even want to get into it because I don't have that much to say about
this
it.
This is a long tangent.
But yeah.
It's fine.
But the monkey's judging the researcher and saying, no, you're doing something wrong by the two of us are equals and we're performing the same task, but we're being rewarded by society, I guess you could say differently for it. And that's not fair. And so you, researcher, are like a bad person. I'm going to freak out and refuse to work with you anymore because of that.
Gosh.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's like totally just full on like judging other people is like genetic. It's not even like a thing that society came up with or that Instagram came up with.
I think Peterson has put it along the lines of I've listened to, for those out there, I have listened to Jordan Peterson a lot.
So just like listen to Peterson instead of us. Just seriously.
Like, go through all of his. I would recommend Toxic Masculinity and Personal Responsibility. Those are the two episodes that I like the most.
You're probably talking about the rats, though, if you're talking about animals.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Rats and just... There's primordial ethics within that. But they're not conscious about it, so they can't say, oh, we should, like, write this down or something like that. But that's what we
with the rats. It's that a big rat has to let a little rat win about 30% of the time in the wrestling matches that they do between each other.
Yeah.
Or else the little rat's not going to. Yeah,
exactly. The little rat just scampers off.
And that's an interesting thing about hierarchies is that rat can't ascend the hierarchy if he's not his hierarchy of being the one that people want to play with. If he doesn't exhibit some sort of fairness or morality by letting the little rats win 30% of the time.
And that's what that's the problem I have with the whole everyone's oppressed and everything's based off power in our society. It's like that's the stupidest theory ever.
If it was true and it's about
partially true.
And it's about human nature, you would think you would find it in the scriptures.
Yeah.
Which you do, but just for the bad guys.
Yeah.
And there's often good guys that counter that and shape history as well.
Because so much of what our society is based off of is reciprocity. It's like, I'm going to rule over you, and that means you're going to do things that I want to do. It's like, no one's going to put up with that.
Mm-mm.
You think people... I mean, people...
And it doesn't happen in apes either.
No.
Like, they looked at it, and the ape with, like, the good people skills... will rule the apes the longest.
Yeah, exactly. 'Cause
the one that's just like really messed up and the strongest is like, okay, that's fine. But after he's a jerk to the two next strongest apes, they can get together and literally rip him in half.
Yeah.
And then there's like the cycle of nations, the strong man and the everything. It happens in apes as well.
Yeah. And that also applies, I guess, to relationships where it's like, there are definitely toxic relationships and people who rule over each other in relationships. But do you really think that women and men just overpowered women, and because of that they stayed with them? Like,
well, especially when you're doing polygamy.
Yeah.
Like that too. Once you get to the point where you have eight wives, it's like, okay, I understand they can't deadlift as much as you, but like eight versus one, like that's a little ridiculous.
I don't understand that. And just, you don't, when you're doing business, just as a general rule, you go to people who have given you a good deal and who's the, like, we got our oil change today at Pep Boys. And it's because we've gone to Pep Boys before and they did a good job. So we paid them. So we went back to Pep Boys.
Yeah. So this episode is sponsored by... No. That would have been a great segue, though. Very natural. We'll have to contact him and see if they...
Hero segue.
And the Michael Knowles segues are like... But you can start, there's a slight change in intonation. I can pick it up like right when it's happening. I can't even explain what it's like. Oh, it's an ad. I know it's an ad. But 60 seconds. Okay.
I like to listen to them sometimes.
That's true. Okay. Wow. We've been talking quite some time. But this does play into a lot of things that we see at BYU.
What are the other questions?
Before we dive into BYU, let's give a little bit of our background specifically with
BYU.
And BYU conservatives. Okay. Yeah. So I guess I'll start. I started the podcast first. I mean, I'd been listening to stuff, but I didn't really go to like the Republican Club or
Turning Point
or anything like that, really. And then the BYU, well, George Floyd died and everybody posted the black squares. And people that were even BYU students that I knew that never posted anything political started posting black squares and the hashtags and stuff. Mm-hmm. And so the meme that I made in my brain and I haven't put out there ever is in Jurassic Park where the Jeeps pull up and he sees the Brontosaurus for the first time and you know, it's all beautiful. And then the camera pans back over to Dr. Ian Malcolm and he's like, he did it. That son of a B word. He did it. And what Malcolm is referring to there in the meme is convincing us that we're all racist. Like, oh my gosh, they finally did it. And it seemed as impossible as creating dinosaurs. And then all of a sudden one day it happened and just everybody was on the same page. And that was like a turning point for my desire to get involved in this stuff. And I started doing, I did research. I mean, I'd already done research and known things, but I started like putting stuff up on Instagram, like, hey, look at these stats. You know, this narrative is not, doesn't explain everything. And then the President Worthen commissioned the Committee on Race, Equity, and Belonging. They put out the report on race, equity, and belonging about 6 months later. And I started reading through it. And one night with my wife, I'm like, you know what? I'm going to start a podcast. And just like right there, I kind of brainstormed through some names, got some artwork, all that jazz, did a lot of research, and put out three episodes that were each like over an hour long, explaining that the U.S. isn't racist, where critical race theory comes from. And then the third episode was going through the report and explaining the problems with all the different things in it. And that was kind of like the impetus that got me going into this. And then it was actually me posting that. I reached out to BYU Conservatives, which used to be run by just one guy, Cannon. Hi, Cannon, if you happen to see this. I've never actually met you before. Or, I know what you look like just from your page, but I've never even met him in person. But I reached out to him and said, hey, could you put this podcast up on your page? Could you promote it on the page? Sure, no problem. He did. It was great. And then a little bit later, he reaches out and says, I'm thinking of leaving the page soon. He reached out to a variety of people and said, I think I'm going to leave the page soon. Does anybody want to take over? And I was like, well, I'm not really an Instagram kind of person, but if nobody else wants to, it's better to keep it going than to not to. Mm-hmm. And so he ended up taking me on. And then...
How long after he took you on did he take me on?
He took me on sometime around May, a year ago.
I got on in August.
Okay, so it was like 3 months later.
Yeah.
And I like never heard of you before or anything. It's just like, here's Cannon. And you're like, hey, I'm going to start posting stuff. And I was like, what is that? Huh?
Yeah.
And you didn't even know Cannon either.
No, I didn't know him either. He just DM'd me. I think it's because I reshared a lot of the posts and I interacted with him a lot. And so he reached out to me, he said, hey, do you want to be a part of the page? And I was like, heck yeah, I'm down to do whatever, because I think there should be more activism quote unquote activism from conservatives at BYU, mm-hmm. just because I think that a lot of conservatives don't, and this is not to offend any conservatives in our audience, which is probably our whole audience, but mm-hmm. if I offend you, just it's whatever.
Take your clappy hands and leave. No.
I think there needs to be more, and our follower base probably is more along the lines of being more involved in politics, but I think there needs to be more pushback at BYU with a lot of the woke stuff that is happening. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, we talked about, it was the pro-life club that couldn't get, that wasn't getting approved.
Yeah.
Stuff like that.
And the race, equity, and belonging race, equity, report. And it's not like things like race, equity, and belonging are that bad, but it's when, like, the first paragraph of the report says, this report was commissioned because of the shocking racist murders of George Floyd and Ahmaud Arbery and Breonna Taylor that bring to light the deep racism of the blah, 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 and BYU is somehow involved in that. It's like, okay, well, see, you lost me on the very first paragraph.
Yeah.
And you also lost the justice system because none of those charges were ever brought. So, like, I mean, we're not living in reality anymore, and we're only on the first page of this 67-page-long report.
They hadn't been brought at that point, but
they commissioned these. The report came out a long time after George Floyd. It was, like, 8 months later. But when it was first commissioned, not a lot of stuff was out. But it's just, like, it was still a really bad situation, but the more things that came out, the more the narrative just was not, but they just stuck with it anyway.
Yeah.
And that's
what they did with Michael Brown
too. This report that's coming out 8 months later, like while the trial is going on practically, mm-hmm. or just before it, is still like, oh yeah, they were totally racist things. And that's the whole reason why this report got started, was because of those mm-hmm. catalysts. It's like, oh, so the full video came out. We can see he said, I can't breathe, at least a dozen times before he was put on the ground, and we're just going to still stick with this narrative.
I mean, if you look at there's a different video from a different angle, and it doesn't, he's more so on his shoulder than his neck.
Did you see Steven Crowder of his video?
Oh, no.
Steven Crowder is about the size of George Floyd, and one of the people that works for him is about the size of Derek Chauvin. Mm-hmm. And they went out and tried to get the same camera angle and the same positioning of the bodies and try to have the most weight on Steven Crowder. And he handcuffed himself, too. So it's like, try to completely simulate it as much as possible and sat there for the entire time that Chauvin did on. And afterwards, the thing that hurt on Crowder the most were his wrists because the handcuffs were too tight. So it's like,
and that's not to make light of the situation.
No, it's not. It's to kind of take it more seriously than other people are. Because instead of trying to, like, obviously he's trying to push a narrative with it, but it's only because the other people tried to push a narrative with it first.
Yeah.
And so it's like, well, are we disrespecting it or brushing under the rug if we try to exactly simulate the conditions that happened and then see what the outcome is? Yeah.
He just didn't have the fentanyl in his system that George Floyd did.
Yeah, it was it was the key difference. Wasn't under a ton of stress from drugs and then being arrested.
Yeah. Like, I think the Ahmaud Arbery case was more so along the lines of racism, because I think the guy, I can't recall exactly, but I think they used the N-word in video beforehand or had on their social media or something.
That one is different. But it's also the only highly publicized case that didn't involve the police.
Yeah.
And this isn't really related to BYU, but it is in the sense that those were like what was cited as the reason why we're bringing all sorts of this kind of CRT flavored stuff into BYU to begin with.
Yeah.
I did do a podcast on the Race, Equity, and Belonging Report. That is episode 3. So if you want to check out that or just go read it yourself, you can do that. But let's actually just get right into issues at BYU. How leftist would you say BYU is?
I think it's minimal, but it's overblown, I think. Because I guess we post about it because I think it's more so in the faculty of BYU. There's people who will just say white people are racist. Mm-hmm. And teach Ibram X. Kendi and how to like teach that, and then white fragility, and then what's the other? So you want to talk about race. Like I've seen those as required readings for several classes. And I think it's definitely centered more in the humanities, sociology, that type of thing. And then even my wife had to read. She had to read So You Want to Talk About Race for a math education class.
And you've read that one, correct?
I listened to it on Audible.
Okay.
But
so. My wife read, she got through about half of it, and I got through about 30 minutes of it. So I'm familiar. Familiar as I want to be.
She literally just rips on her mom in the book.
Yeah.
Like, because her mom was white. So you want to talk about race. I don't remember.
Ijoma Oluwu.
Something like that. But she just rips on her mom because her mom had said something to a coworker, something along the lines of, oh, I have a black daughter. I know things about race. And then her daughter talked to her like, Ijoma, what was it again?
Huh?
The name again.
Oh, Ijoma Oluwu.
Ijoma, yeah. She talked to her mom and had a conversation about how she was being racist. And then she talks about this in the book. And I'm like, you know, you can talk about things that are racist, but you probably shouldn't rip on your mom in your novel that's going to sell thousands of copies.
And to add on to what you're saying, if you do decide to complain about your mom and call her racist in the book, then maybe that's not a book that BYU classes should would want to have as required reading. As required reading, exactly. Yeah.
And also with how to be an anti-racist, like, if I would request everyone to actually go read the book, but this is a highlight on page 18 and 19. It basically talks about...
And he doesn't have it in front of him, ladies and gentlemen. This is straight off the top of his head.
Because this is just... It's abhorrent ideology. Because he first talks about if there's inequity, it means basically that there's inequality of outcome. Unequal outcome is racist. And that anything that makes an equal outcome is anti-racist. But you can literally not find any, like, Russians make more than Irish. Russian Americans make more than Irish Americans. There's no conspiracy theory about Russian Americans being racist or discriminatory towards Irish Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Nigerian Americans make more than Irish Americans. You can't achieve equality of outcome between anybody. Like, you can have a room full of people, split it down the middle, and there will be unequal outcomes. And that doesn't mean that racism doesn't exist or that racism doesn't occur with black and white Americans. But to say that racism is the primary factor and only factor of how Kendi claims is just absurd on its face. Because you can talk about the single parenthood rate in the black community in America, which is around 70%. Whites, it's around 30%. I think Asians, around 15%.
Mm-hmm.
Don't quote me on that exactly to the point, but that's generally how it is. But that's exactly also how incomes break down. Like Asian Americans have the most, then whites, and then blacks. I guess I think Hispanics are around 40% single parenthood rate or 50%, but I can't remember off the top of my head. But that's exactly also how income lines up. And I'm not saying correlation equals causation, but that's also another factor you should probably take into account.
Well, they're the ones that are like correlation equals causation, but
it's not even correlation.
It can only be
because
disparities equal discrimination.
Yeah, because you're not even measuring the fallacy. You're not even measuring the discrimination at that point. You're just saying disparities means there is discrimination. It's like not necessarily. Groups of people and cultures develop different things, and then when those expand, I guess the market's going to decide what value to place on that. I mean, what about the? You could argue, to make a point, how many people or what demographics of people are taking Africana studies at BYU. Mm-hmm. And it's probably overrepresentatively black. But it's also Africana studies. And are you going to say an anti-racist policy would introduce more white people to Africana studies? Or are you going to say to introduce more white people to the STEM studies because they tend to lean more Asian. So it just falls apart when you look at it that way. I would argue with anybody, no matter their skin color, about this stuff. And
have done it in the past.
I've done it a lot. And like I argued with plenty of people about this stuff. And then I'll talk to my Jamaican companion that I had on the mission about this stuff. And he's like totally, he agrees with me on a lot of it. And I say, this is like, not everyone has your viewpoint. And Jamaica is highly politically incorrect, I would say, just culturally.
Yeah.
He just came and he was perplexed by how obsessed with race we were.
But sometimes you embrace it. Mm-hmm. Some people embrace it. Like, there's a guy that was on radio with Eric Bibee a while ago and has posted some stuff on an Instagram page called Stop Your Silence. I think his name is Don Izakor. And he came to the United States to go to college from Nigeria. And at first he said, I was like, what? They're talking about race all the time. But then he just, like, something about the way he was introduced to it, he just, like, fully embraced the, if you're a black person, that means you're certain things about you and oppressed, that people assume things about you. And, well, it's funny because he said what he didn't like was people just, like, assuming stuff about him because he was black, or, like, noticing that he was black. So you might say, oh, we should be colorblind. Oh, no, 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 he can't be colorblind. Ryan Gabriel told us that that is Satan's plan, is to try to make us colorblind.
Colorblindness.
God is colorblind, but because society isn't, justice. Satan tries to make us colorblind like God is, which is bad because society, it's like, it's a whole tangled mess.
Like, why do you think the...
But that brings it to, like, the problem with BYU. Where do we see the opposite message of that being shared at BYU?
Oh, yeah.
We had it a little bit with Amy Chua, which was good.
Yeah.
I noticed that a lot of the... Because I try and, like, follow the other side, I guess you could say, specifically about BYU. Hardly anybody at all talked about her form address. Mm-hmm. And it's probably because she's somebody who is a little bit on the left, I would say, slightly, at least maybe socially. And then she's saying, the people on the right, their main problem is they have some neo-Nazi racist rallies in Washington, D.C.
Which are few and far between.
And then her complaint about the left is... Tons of people in institutions and tons of best-selling books tell white people that they're racist just for being white. It's like, okay, I think... And she says, oh, both sides
have... And that's taught at university.
Like, both sides have equal problems. It's like, okay, both sides have equal problems, but I think the problems can be equal in severity, but unequal in prevalence.
Yeah,
and being a neo-Nazi's as severe as thinking all white people are racist, but one is definitely more prevalent than the other.
Yeah. Like, I got into an argument on social media the other day with someone, and I said, they brought up, they said, that's your privileged white opinion. And I said, wait, there's, like, a lot of black conservatives that have the same opinion as me, and I say that, and I think I said there's, like, Candace Owens. And then she said, she's just getting paid and gets the money, and she couldn't succeed in the liberal politics. And I'm saying, that's probably one of the most racist things you could say. It's like... All the black people that are conservative, like Clarence Thomas, Candace Owens, Brandon Tatum, like, you literally have an ideology that says if, because it goes both ways. If a black person doesn't agree with me, they are only in it for the money, basically, is what they're saying. And it's like there's other black people who are conservative besides politicians. And don't earn any money because of their viewpoint.
Yeah.
And that's so, like, that's so pernicious.
It's
like,
a lot.
You have to agree with me because you are black.
There's two halves of me that at BYU wants to approach this because on one hand, I think, oh, we should, like, reach out. We could probably, through the page, find somebody who knows somebody that's black that thinks these same things as we do about BYU. And they can come out and say, I don't like anti-racist being taught. I don't like Ijoma Olu. So you want to talk about race being taught. I don't like people thinking I'm automatically oppressed. I don't like, you know, there's probably somebody like that at BYU. So I kind of want to do that to give them a voice and present kind of the different side and to break this illusion that all black people think this way. But at the same time, I don't want to just, like, go find a black person to say the things that, you know. But, yeah, it's kind of either or. And I kind of did that to an extent with the article that we just put out, that I just put out, talking about LGBTQ stuff. The thing is, I met James, the one of the people that gave a comment. And we'd already talked about that. And he, like, volunteered that information to me when I just met him recently. So I felt comfortable, like, reaching out.
Yeah,
but his comments were very insightful. Like, people thinking... And, I mean, if you're gay, you might have this notion that you speak for the whole community a little more than if you're just an ally, quote-unquote. But even if you are gay, you don't, like... A gay student at BYU, you don't speak on behalf of everybody. You speak for yourself. Anyway, he made the point of saying, people who try and speak on behalf of me actually cause me more isolation when they say that I can't stand up for the church policies when they're trying to destroy the accreditation of the institution I'm trying to get a degree at.
Yeah.
It'd be a little inconvenient for him if BYU happened to lose its accreditation and his degree doesn't mean anything. I don't think that would alleviate the problems that attend to you when you're a gay member of the church.
Yeah.
I say gay because it's faster to say. I should say, like, experience the same-sex attraction because it's not your defining characteristic.
Yeah.
Oh, well, I took the shortcut. My bad.
When people say things like the gay experience or the white experience or the black experience, I'm just saying, no, it's your experience. I was listening to FAIR, the Looking on their Page, because we talked to Quick Media about it.
What is that acronym?
It's
Foundation
Against Intolerance and Racism.
Intolerance and Racism.
And they talked about an Asian kid who was reading a book about someone who's from, I think it was India. I can't remember if it was, like, if it was that exactly. But he didn't identify with the person because they were Indian I think they were black. But he didn't identify with them because of that. He didn't identify because they were both minorities. He identified with the main character in the book because he or she had a relationship problem with their father. And so did he. And I think that's so much more impactful than saying we should have people have representation because of skin color. Like, I personally find Bruce Lee really inspiring because I'm into fitness. And that's one, he's just a legend in the fitness realm and also just in general. And I don't care that he's Asian or that he's not white. I think that people should have that perspective more of saying, that's a good person. It doesn't matter their skin color. It doesn't matter their sexuality. They did something that that I'm inspired by and that I should aspire to do.
And that you can achieve, even though you might not be the same color or something else like that.
Like the whole role model thing. Like, I need someone to be a role model who's my skin color. And I think that when people say we need someone who's black who's a good example, someone who's white, someone who's Asian, it just devalues their accomplishments because then you're just saying, I want to go be like this person because they're the same race as me.
That is a problem because race equity in Bollingen Port and things like along the line, I haven't looked at many of their things, but the Black Menaces and some of the comments at the BYU accreditation meeting that I looked through, so much of it was, if people aren't like me and they're talking about race, then I can't feel accepted or like I can't perform at my best. And it's problematic.
I think it's problematic because the viewpoint has been entrenched into culture that, and then people are more likely to pick it up. But we should focus.
I don't know how, like, if somebody thinks that and they're a different race, I just don't have very much faith that I could
resolve
anything I could say would alleviate that because you can just kind of automatically dismiss your white, you don't understand.
Yeah.
I was like, well, I did go to Africa on my mission and I was in an apartment. There was six of us and we were all from different countries. So five of them were black. I was white. I saw another white guy, maybe on P-Day, and maybe we would talk for 15 minutes.
Yeah,
I don't think you are that isolated from other people of your color. And they're all Americans, too. I mean, when I was in Africa, part of what I was dealing with is like half the people I would talk to probably wouldn't be able to name a single Disney film. Like, this is the level of different culture that we're talking about here. And it was very difficult. The funny thing is, I was actually in my second transfer. No, I spoke English. They spoke all sorts of stuff, but enough of them spoke English that it was an English speaking mission.
I spoke English in Utah.
Okay. Yeah. Really? Surprising. In Oro?
Wow. Oro, Utah. There's so many languages spoken.
I know. It's the spelling of names is a little funny, but other than that, it's mostly English. But in my like second transfer, I had a white missionary, and he gave me like this whole talk about how I need to try to integrate myself more in the culture and go and hang out with the African missionaries more and not try and be with. And I'm like, dude, I'm just still like trying to adjust to the fact that I'm flushing my toilet with a bucket and drinking water out of bags. Like, could you chill on like the cultural integration? I'm doing it as fast as I can. Okay, man. Yeah.
But how long had you been out at that point?
It was like my second transfer, so it was like 7 weeks or something like that.
Yeah. I wasn't even integrated to the Utah culture by that.
Yeah, so. They were. But yeah, then he like chastises me for that. So there's like this culture, like it was a very different thing, but I was expected to like, yeah, integrate in with the people and like deal with it, man. And like that was kind of what I was told. Mm-hmm. And I don't really resent him for saying that. But then if you're an African and you're already an American, you're like adjusted to America. And then you come here and you're complaining about not having other black people around you. It's like, I get it to an extent, but
it also has to do with the church.
Having
the majority of the demographics in the church just in general are white.
Yeah. But that should be like another thing that makes it easier to hang out with people. Like you don't have to worry. Well, for the most part, you don't have to worry about them doing many activities that you wouldn't be comfortable doing with it. I mean, mm-hmm. if you went to another college mm-hmm. that had more black people as a member of the church, I would imagine that you would feel more isolated there mm-hmm. than here at BYU. I don't know. I'm
just
not
because it's religiously affiliated.
Yeah. And I'm sure it varies on a case by case thing. So that's why we can't broadly generalize about the experience of every single black person mm-hmm. at BYU. But let's talk about, let's kind of and keep on the BYU subject, but say, what are some things going on at BYU? Not necessarily classes, but do you see any sort of policies that you think need to change at BYU?
The honor code, rule about beards.
I think it's unnecessary at this point.
Yeah, it was brought up in different circumstances than we're living in now.
Yeah.
The beard was the like a symbol. And
yeah.
Yeah. But that's not really like woke type
no,
of stuff.
No, that's not woke stuff.
There
that's,
are,
just, that's BYU stuff.
There are two things that I was just made aware of yesterday that BYU changed. Mm-hmm. Apparently, in following with Elder Holland's talk, which I was happy because I didn't think that anything had happened mm-hmm. due to Elder Holland's talk. But one was they used to do diversity, equity, and inclusion trainings somewhere on campus.
Yeah.
It was a girl that like worked with this company. And it was a BYU student complaining that after Elder Holland's talk, they stopped doing trainings with them. So that was something that was happening that's no longer happening.
I think that's great.
That I think is good. You can look at other places to see why we're saying that's good. We're not against diversity, equity, and inclusion.
Yeah, it's just that diversity, equity, and inclusion are amorphous terms that can mean a lot of stuff and so happen to be most of the time left-wing ideology and woke stuff.
And then the second policy that was recently changed that I didn't know about, it was in the Tribune, actually, the Salt Lake Tribune, is that BYU, they have a speech clinic, apparently, that gives free services to students. And I wrote this up in the article. Back in February, they decided to stop giving care, I'm using quotes, to people who were gender transitioning, trans people. Mm-hmm. So the church handbook says transitioning your gender results in disciplinary action. Like mm-hmm. you're not supposed to do it as a member of the church. Yeah. And then the tithing money goes to BYU. And then BYU provides free professional services to people to do the transition that the handbook tells them not to. I don't know how this was happening. I don't know how this was happening before. So I'm happy that that one changed. Mm-hmm. We could work on the forum speakers a little more, which is something that we discussed. Because Ryan Gabriel, Bishop Robert Barron III or something like Robert Barron. I keep trying to call him Robert Barron. Mm-hmm. But that's like a muckraker back in the Industrial Revolution type of term. What is his name? Bishop somebody. Barber. William Barber.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, so Ryan Gabriel, William Barber, and Martin Luther King III, and then like a couple other people.
Yeah.
The problem is they'll just like say something, they'll like slide something in there, and it's just implied that if you're a good person, you believe this.
Yeah. Like you should think that we should use the government to heal all poverty in the nation.
Yeah. Like it's always use the government, climate change, voting rights, poverty, racism, please something.
Yeah. Anti-racist.
Anti-racism, the trainings, gender affirmation, whatever, just all that stuff. And they won't explain why the other side is wrong. It's just like, be a good person, and therefore support this, and they just kind of like slide it in and move on to the next topic.
With the I never said the quote from the How to Be an Anti-Racist book. The exact quote. It says in the book, you guys can look at this yourself because you brought up Gabriel and then anti-racism. I just thought about it. It says that if discrimination is producing equity, then it's anti-racist. If it's producing inequity, then it's racist.
And this is Ibram X. Kendi.
Yeah, this is Ibram X. Kendi. The only way to remedy past discrimination is present discrimination. The only way to remedy present discrimination is future discrimination.
So it's just equality of outcomes at any cost.
At any cost.
Including discrimination.
Yeah. And you don't, you don't talk about the Asian population who makes more than whites in America. And it's only economic. They're only looking at economic outcomes. They're not looking at anything else, I guess. But if you really want equality of outcome between all the races, then you're going to have to do a lot of coercion and force, because people also make personal choices. Like, blacks are overrepresented in Africana studies, but also Asians are overrepresented in STEM. And I think whites are overrepresented in business. And I don't think it should have anything to do with anyone's race when they choose a major. Because you should just decide what you want to do. And of course, if there's a culture in a major that is toxic for someone, I think that because of discriminatory culture, and I can't name one that I know of at BYU.
But yeah, well, BYU is probably the best because it would appear, and they've done research on this, and Jonathan Haidt talks about this, that conservatives are the ones that experience the most problems. This comes from like self-polling. So it's like your opinion about how you feel. This conservatives but they are more likely to say that they don't want to speak their mind as much and all that kind of stuff. And even I was talking to people recently, because that's the fun thing about the Instagram, is we get to talk with people. And there are a number of BYU students who are conservative who feel that way. Even though BYU is more conservative, they don't want to rock the boat in their classes, especially if it seems to go against what their professors are saying. And this is in a variety of places. I've heard it in education. I've heard it in some business type stuff. I've heard it in humanities. It is very odd that people with kind of conservative views are telling me, and maybe their personalities are a little different, but like, why are they telling me they don't feel comfortable just saying stuff that they think is backed up by the facts in a class at BYU? So it is a problem, it seems like. But maybe it's kind of a problem with conservatives being, we're a little too cautious, maybe. Or people went to BYU just thinking everybody's going to be on the same page at BYU because we're all members of the church. And then they get there and they're like, oh, wait, it's not that. Freaks them out. I'm spitballing here. I don't know if that's what or
it's just people don't want to speak up, like
just general agreeableness.
I mean, I wouldn't say it's agreeableness. I think
there's a difference between being agreeable and thinking I'm gonna get a bad grade if I say something. But I don't think you should be thinking that at BYU either.
I don't think you should think that either. I mean, I in that sociology class, there were a few times where I questioned my grade on some stuff and I complained about it and my grade got raised on it. But I think people have to speak up more, because if you don't say anything, then it just gets worse, basically. And if you are afraid to get graded down because of your viewpoint, it's like, which would you rather stand for?
I guess you're not really learning in that class anymore. So what is its purpose?
Yeah, exactly. And so I would say, but I wouldn't bend to the professor's desires if you know that it's wrong, or if you feel that it's wrong, because you want to be able to express your viewpoint, especially in classes where that's important and there's discussion, or there's supposed to be discussion, because I know that that happens in classes too.
What do you see in the future for BYU?
What do I see in the future? I think BYU either has to, well, I think either the church itself is going to bring down the hammer on BYU with some of the stuff that's being taught, or BYU will do it itself. Or they will just get kicked to the curb by the church and not have church funding, and then it'll become a university, like Intermountain Healthcare became, because the church was in charge of a lot of the hospitals. And then after a while.
This is news to me. Really?
I think so. I think...
Like it owned them and now it doesn't anymore?
I think so. I think Greg talked about it.
I think this is... Maybe he did. But I think this relates to a question that we got from people, which we will get to. We've kind of touched on a lot of them now. But it... Okay. Do you think BYU should stop getting tithing money? And they reference Mormon 8:37-38. I don't know quite what they're referencing off the top of my head, so I'll look it up. But what first thoughts if somebody says BYU lose tithing money?
I guess I'm torn because some of the things that are being taught at BYU definitely aren't within the purview of the church.
What would you say are the big things?
I would say CRT, critical race theory stuff, like even Rex Kendi. I don't know why that is even considered academic literature. Mm-hmm. Like in the first, this is the, in the definitions, the first chapter of the book where he defines racist and anti-racist, he says, as to define racist, it's an idea or policy that is racist, basically. And I'm just saying, you didn't define the word. Like that wasn't, you just used the word in the definition. That's a self-fulfilling...
It's a circular...
Circular definition. And it's like, you are teaching this at BYU. Mm-hmm. I mean, and then it says that you should discriminate against people because of past discrimination. Like,
it's not even being taught at BYU because some people say, oh, people should be presented with different ideas, mm-hmm. even if some of them might be wrong. It's like, well, you only have a limited amount of time to teach stuff in the school, so you need to prioritize things that are going to be useful, and things that are wrong are not useful to prioritize. Yeah. But in addition to that, that isn't even what's happening.
It's the only thing that's
being
taught.
It's being in the classes that talk about this kind of stuff. That's what's being taught. Like mm-hmm. the Kennedy Center had How to Be Anti-Racist as their book. And Ryan Gabriel, I'm not like letting the cat out of the bag. This is already out there publicly that he mm-hmm. said this. So I'm not harassing people mm-hmm. for those who might be confused about that. And he's holding up the book and he's in his spirit voice that he likes to talk. And apparently he used it during like his entire form devotional that he gave, and it's like, this book teaches, I think, can give us a new view of Christ and his mission as a change maker or something like that. It's and like, I hope your testimony has changed and improved, and I hope you can go to your parents and tell them the ways in which your testimony of our Savior has improved. Increased. And he's like holding the book up, you know, practical value saying, it's like, this book develops your view of Christ beyond what the scriptures do, and you need to proselytize that. That is very disturbing. It's definitely worthy of tithing money being withheld.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I actually found the verse that he's referencing. It's what's the verse? Yeah, it's Mormon, you know. So, behold, ye do love money and your substance and your fine apparel and the adorning of your churches. O ye polluters, da-da-da, why are you ashamed to take upon you the name of Christ? Why do you not think that greater is the value of an endless happiness than misery which never dies? Okay. I'm not necessarily saying that's Ryan Gabriel. Mm-hmm. But I would say that BYU doesn't need to lose tithing money. I would say BYU needs to change. And if that means losing accreditation or other stuff, kind of like Elder Holland says, mm-hmm. then that's what we should try to be losing, because education and education involved or incorporating the spirit and the scriptures and stuff mm-hmm. like that is very important. And BYU is one of the few places that you can get it.
Yeah.
So we should, if something's going to get cut off, it should be the official accreditation and praise of the world before the church should just cut BYU off. Because it takes a lot of tithing money, but it's still serving a purpose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And also, I mean, I think that this is to emphasize the point of tithing money being used to sponsor BYU. Because the business school literally said, I don't remember who I heard this from, but the business school literally said to BYU, hey, we could go independent because the business school is just, the business school is freaking insanely good at what it does. Mm-hmm. And the church came out, came and said to them, no, you can't get off of tithing money because we want this to be a church-sponsored school.
Yeah.
And I think that that's really important because the symbolic meaning behind tithing is so that, and the actual meaning, not just the symbolic meaning, it's that this is given up to the Lord to improve the kingdom of God. And mm-hmm. if that means educating people who are in the church, then that's a good place to put it in. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying also that we shouldn't change, because I do definitely think that we should change so that tithing money and that education can continue without principles that are antithetical to the church. Mm-hmm. I don't think that they should be not necessarily not taught, but I think that they should have another viewpoint. Like, you're not going to find Thomas Sowell's Race and Politics books mm-hmm. in all of these sociology classes within the teaching COT. Because mm-hmm. if you taught discrimination disparities, it's so much more academic than something like how to be an anti-racist. He cites stats and figures like almost every other sentence.
Yeah, long bibliographies.
And it's a very, very academic, and it's referenced. Like, he talks about the thing, this is a tangent, but something like ebonics, which I think is a nonsense term because
I haven't even heard of that.
Ebonics, it's basically Black English. Culturally Black English. Like things like axed and
yeah.
Stuff like
that. I know Sowell does like to talk about that. Yeah. Yeah,
he talks about that. But that came from, and he references this, and it's proved by studies as well, that came from the white settlers, that form of language and slang came from the white settlers in, I can't remember which part of England, but I think it was the southern part of the UK, and they came to the south, and that's how they spoke, and culturally Blacks picked up on that, because if you look at IQ scores between Blacks and whites during World War II, Northern Blacks had higher IQ scores than Southern whites. Mm-hmm. And it was because of that cultural difference, like, it was very...
Yeah, what the culture valued.
The culture valued very false, prideful expressions of manliness. He references stuff in the book, like getting into fist fights, things like that. And mm-hmm. just like gang type of culture. Like, but also being laid back and not working as much. Mm-hmm. Like, that was from UK. But that culture also stayed there, and it affected Southern Blacks. But then there were cities in the North that weren't segregated, and Southern Blacks with that culture moved in, and the cities became segregated as a result.
Yes. Yep. And Chicago,
yeah, Chicago,
the Bay, he talks about this, the discrimination disparities. It was the Black people in places like Chicago and San Francisco that didn't want the Black people from the South moving in. Talking about BYU and how this stuff came to BYU.
I know, I just keep getting
Well, it's fun to talk about these things. I can't even remember what we were talking about before. So I guess I'll just do like a hard left and say a question that people came up with was, what caused the 180-degree change in culture here at BYU? So I think what they're asking is, maybe they went to BYU before, or maybe they're here now, I don't know, but kind of like this idea of everything was perfect in the 1950s, and then suddenly everything got reversed. I can't really speak to what BYU was like a while ago.
I have no idea.
But even since I started here, because I started before my mission, so it's been like 7 years since I started BYU, and these conversations are not things that I was cognizant of or aware of or anything when I was a freshman. It doesn't seem like it was like this before. And I think part of what you have to understand is, it would seem kind of odd if just BYU came up with this internally by itself mm-hmm. all of a sudden.
Yeah.
That would be very odd. You have to remember that this is the way I kind of am thinking about it these days, is the students at BYU are in BYU. They live and breathe BYU. Some of them live on BYU property. They might not leave BYU property for an entire week or two. But professors are not like that. Mm-hmm. They teach maybe 3 classes max, sometimes less than that. And sure, they do a lot of prep for their classes and grading and answering questions and all that kind of stuff. But a fair amount of their time is also spent researching. And when they're doing that, they're interacting with other professors outside of BYU. The professors aren't in the BYU bubble, even though they're BYU professors. And so sociology, and Jonathan Haidt has talked about this, things like sociology and law and education and other liberal arts have really taken a turn in the past decade. And this is objective. It's not like subjective opinion. Like, the number of conservatives has they drop it off dramatically, and it's become very orthodox. Mm-hmm.
I think it's 83% of people who are in sociology are either liberal or Marxist.
Yeah.
Like, that's an actual stat.
I think Marxist was in the 18 to 23%.
There were more Marxists than conservatives.
Yeah.
Sociology.
Purposes. Conservatives is like some places, some universities.
It was like 3 or 4%.
Yeah. And some places just don't have one.
Yeah.
Like, there are some psychology and humanities departments at universities don't have a single one in them. Mm-hmm. And those professors are in their echo chambers and talking and doing all this research and getting a lot of money for it. And the BYU professors are doing research and writing papers with these people and, mm-hmm. and that kind of stuff. So it probably came mostly from the professors, mm-hmm. although social media has really come to the fore in the last 7 years or so. And there's a lot of political stuff that happens on there. Mm-hmm. But if I were to say, first of all, did BYU do a 180 to bring it back to the question? Kind of. It seems like. Kind of. Where did it come from? Mostly the professors, I would think. Mm-hmm. But students who, I mean, when you're a freshman, you graduate high school. I'm not saying they're stupid or anything. There's great people that are freshmen and really have their head on their shoulders and stuff, especially if you're an RM. But you haven't been exposed to this level of idea, well, not mm-hmm. level, but this category before, because mm-hmm. you were focused more on basic econ, government, math, English, Shakespeare, that kind of stuff, and you've never heard of critical theories or systemic this or that before. And so when it's taught to you at the beginning, and you're saying a prayer before and after class, and the professor might be saying something like Ryan Gabriel of, and this should help strengthen your testimony of Jesus Christ, especially if you're coming into it as like, BYU is the greatest institution in the world, bar none. It's just a completely spiritual, amazing experience. And then you hear that, I don't, like, your sensors are probably way toned down and you might just kind of eat it. And it has a very nice activism, save the world flavor to it, which is mm-hmm. very appealing to young people. Yeah.
There's a psychological term for that. I think it's, for the lack of a better term, it's like a savior complex. When you're younger, you want to change the world.
Yeah.
But then when you grow up and pay taxes, you quickly realize, that, oh, I have to do a lot of stuff to change the world. And also the world, as it is, has a lot of good, but also I have to pay taxes.
Yeah, it's a miracle that we are where we are right now. Yeah. Like, we should be very careful before we try to change it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you just, it's the professors being an authority, and they're the main authority figure that you're dealing with mm-hmm. at BYU. And then maybe you have an activist roommate, and then it's just like a new thing and you haven't really heard the other side before mm-hmm. for some students. I think that is just like kind of the triple threat. I actually haven't really met anybody who, while they were at BYU, became aware of all this stuff. Mm-hmm. So maybe I'm just like talking off the top of my head and making up this person in my mind, this like mm-hmm. imaginary freshman that comes in. And although there has been letters, mm-hmm. I haven't gotten them because we don't like talk to parents a lot.
No.
There's a couple, but somebody like Greg Madsen will get letters from concerned parents, or Elder Holland read a letter from a concerned, I think it was a parent. No, mm-hmm. she was talking about her friend, that things like this do happen at BYU. And I'm just kind of trying to guess as to why it might happen.
I'm not sure exactly why it would happen. I don't think that there's been, I've heard of studies done that says that it doesn't really change people's views, and then some that it does. So I guess this is inconclusive, but
what specifically?
College changes people's views.
Like, oh, really? Some say that it doesn't.
Some say that it doesn't. Some say that it does.
Hmm. Okay.
But I can imagine some people who aren't as political as, because I know a girl at my work, their family is pretty conservative, but she started saying things to her brother that I also know, and I talked to him at one time, and he said she just started bringing stuff up that was nonsense from the left, and I had to shut it down because she was an education major.
Mm-hmm.
My wife is in math education, but in education you have to do multicultural education class, and you had to learn about stuff like how to apply diversity training in your teaching of elementary school kids, all this stuff,
mm-hmm.
like homophobia, diversity, all these things. And she was getting spoon-fed it in this multiple multicultural education class. And then, but her brother's more politically active, and he said, no, that's just nonsense. And she's still conservative, but she started to feel like she should talk about these things and or address them. And I don't think we shouldn't address them, but also you should address them in the proper way. It's just so dumb. The focus on race and just, I am prideful about my race. I think you can be prideful about your culture. I think that's a completely different thing. Mm-hmm. And that can be connected with
race somewhat. They're intertwined to an extent, yeah.
But also, I don't go around being proud that I'm Irish, because I am Irish.
Okay.
And we had ham and cabbage on St. Patrick's Day. But
so we should be like mortal enemies, right? Because I'm mostly Swedish.
You're Swedish? Oh, okay.
There's probably some animosity at some point there.
I mean, I'm also German and English.
Oh, okay, me too.
And Scottish.
There we go. We can like each other.
And Polish.
But how do you think that people who are very much in the gospel and active and all that stuff can be introduced to CRT and say, ooh, sounds good? Like, how does that, in your opinion, how does that happen?
Carefully with euphemisms, like critical race theory, be an anti-racist, like read this book.
Yeah, okay. I mean, you're in the gospel and you hear something like, we should be anti-racist, and you're like, perfect, sounds awesome.
Sorry, it just means you should be against racism. It's like, I mean, if you want to define it that way, then everyone should be an anti-racist, but that's not how it's defined, mm-hmm. as per what D. Rex Kennedy says, because he's kind of the arbiter of the term. Mm-hmm. I think it was around before him, but he really emphasized it, and now it's everywhere, so... he's kind of the source, mm-hmm. is what I've come to conclude. So if you really want to go to the source, he doesn't say...
There's a lot of other people, though.
Yeah, there's a lot of other
Stefanchik. People. Wait, that's one, right?
Stefanchik.
Delgado. Crenshaw. And then if you zoom back a little bit, you've got the Frankfurt School and Gramsci and Marx. And
but that was more critical race theory and the anti-racist
That's term. Where it came from.
Yeah. That's where it comes from, but I don't think the anti-racist term came from that. I may be wrong on that, but...
I do understand how people who are strong in the gospel can start to go along with CRT. Mm-hmm. And I guess if it's done slowly enough and with enough euphemisms, you can kind of get deep into it. Mm-hmm. Although I think for some people, they will and they have like come to a point and they're like, oh, wait a second. Like, this doesn't make sense. But I'm not going to say names or specifics or anything, but there was a family member that reached out to my other family members kind of in this proselytizing thing, like Ryan mm-hmm. Gabriel was saying. And I think it was an email to a variety of family members saying, maybe we should start teaching our kids more about race and raising the cultural consciousness, if we're going to use mm-hmm. the technical terms. I don't know if she used that term.
Yeah.
And like, I want to start having conversations with them and getting books and reading it to them and that kind of stuff. Yeah. And... another family member who was a little more into it was like, oh, what? What's happening? And so they started to have a conversation. I think it was public or like a group thing back and forth. And they were like, oh, well, you know that this kind of ideas actually come from Marx and these type of things. They kind of tried to show that this person where it was coming from. And you would think like, oh, they realized that. But her reaction at first was, oh, I don't really know that much about Marx. But from what I've seen, it just seems like he wants to share and be nice. It's like, oh, no. Like, oh, my gosh. Okay.
Just share your stuff or we'll throw you in the gulag.
But not a success story in terms of like convincing this person. That's kind of sad. Another question that somebody asked, though, was, have you seen any success stories?
I know of some people that have done it. Like, a guy we know has changed people's minds by just asking them simple questions like, do you think there's other factors besides racism that contribute to unequal outcomes? Mm. And then people mm-hmm. will say, yes. Okay. Is this disparity racist? Then, or is it just a result of racism? Like, because you agreed that racism can result in unequal outcomes, but then there's also other factors that can result in unequal outcomes.
Yeah. It's not hard to find a couple of examples.
So how do you then differentiate?
Yeah.
And I know that he's had success with that because he's talked to us about it.
Nobody's ever like come onto our page and said, I read some of your stuff and changed my mind.
Yeah.
That hasn't ever happened.
I feel like it's because it's a social media page. Because social media pages are really poor conduits to change people's minds.
Yeah, something like BYU Conservatives, you have to be realistic with what you're expecting from it. Mm-hmm.
It's just, it's difficult to change people's minds on social media. Mm-hmm. Because you go down a thread and you have like a bunch of different comments and then you get into an argument and you say, I'm going to have the last word. No, I'm going to have the last word, basically. And then you just try to punch down to each other. But the real way to change people's minds is just talking to them face to face and then bringing up points that they would agree with that mm-hmm. also align with your views. Because there's a lot of, I would say, cognitive dissonance. And I'm not saying that the right doesn't have cognitive dissonance, but just cognitive dissonance as a whole on the left saying, like, and that's summarized by the whole what is a woman thing. Mm-hmm. And then people can't answer it because they don't want to answer it because that exposes the whole cognitive dissonance between a woman who's transgender isn't actually a biological woman. Mm-hmm. And if you say that that's based in a social construct, but sex is based in biology, but then you say, oh, but wait, you have to remove your breast tissue and get false genitalia mm-hmm. in order to transition or to become a woman, you have to mutilate your genitalia and then get false breast tissue and take hormones, which are all biological and physical means to help you with a social construction. Mm-hmm. But if it's a social construction, you should just be able to do it and not have a problem with it.
I'm going to bring this back to BYU again, and I'm actually going to do it. Why in the world, and I'm going to do it in a good segue type of way, why do BYU professors have and are allowed to have pronouns in their bio? First of all, is that a fundamental rejection of the principles of the Family Proclamation to the world?
It is, but I don't think that they think it is at times.
Yeah.
I think people just find it to be a polite gesture.
Yeah, I think it's
on surface.
I'm nice. This seems like a nice thing, and therefore no further thought is required.
Yeah. Well, like a girl in one of my classes, she said, it's so easy to just put your pronouns in your emails. And like, yeah, it's easy in action, but ideologically, no, that's not easy.
That kind of is what makes it, that should be like the red flag that it might not be the right thing to do.
Yeah.
If it's just if
it's so easy, but a lot of people aren't doing it, that's probably a reason why.
Yeah. If everybody's doing it and it's really easy, then it might not be the most virtuous thing or the most correct thing, the most aligned with truth type of thing.
Because even if I say he, him in my Bible, that means I'm buying into the ideology. It says that I think that I could also put she, her in there and you would be totally fine with it. Mm-hmm. But you know that I'm a guy and I can lift like 400 pounds.
Yeah.
That might have been a slight brag right there.
If you were the king, the supreme ruler of BYU for a certain amount of time, for a week, like what would be your fantasies of what you would want to accomplish?
One thing I would take out the beard rule and the honor code. Mm-hmm. A couple of these won't have to do with politics, but I would probably only have people, max, you can sing one hymn verse before class.
Oh, okay. One hymn verse. I was like, are there classes that sing three hymns before?
Not three hymns, but just a one hymn verse. Because sometimes I'm on like the third verse in a hymn and I'm just saying, I am in
college. Is this religion class?
Yeah, religion class.
Okay.
But
I was like, outside of religion, I've never sung a hymn.
No, it's happened. But I'm just like,
If I was supreme ruler, I would actually reverse that decision immediately. Oh, you would? Okay. I really like the hymns.
No. Okay. I would have teachers, if they're teaching critical race theory, to also teach Thomas Sowell discrimination disparities or something along those lines. Mm-hmm. Because if you really look into the text of both of those, one is so much more thought out than the other. Mm-hmm. And Thomas Sowell, he talks about race all the time. Like, it's not that he's... Because my problem with, I guess, people who study race
is that they're always on the left. It's like, now there's not a lot of people on the right that study race issues.
Yeah.
But Thomas Sowell has, and he's on the right, and his arguments are just so specific and statistic based that you can't really argue with them sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
So I would do that, because critical race theory, it literally says, like, one of the facets of it is challenging liberalism, like westernized, Western
classical
liberalism.
Yeah.
Not big L liberalism, small L liberalism.
Which is why so many liberal professors are also angry about it.
Yeah.
Is there anything else you'd want to do in your brief stint as supreme leader of BYU?
I wouldn't make religion classes required.
Really?
Yeah.
What?
I would say
what?
You have to go to institute instead, basically.
But you would say you have to go to institute.
Yeah, you have to go to institute, but okay. You're not graded on it.
Interesting.
I find the grading on the religion classes to sometimes be annoying because I'm not even getting any credit for this.
I guess I'll say if I was supreme leader of BYU, American heritage teaches about America, tone down the econ side of it, mm-hmm. teaches about America and the Constitution, original sources required for all students. He cannot get around it.
My professor...
Like students can now.
Yeah. My professor, Grant Madsen, he was my American heritage professor, and he was fantastic. I thought he balanced both sides along the lines of traditional American history versus, like, some of the viewpoints that people have now about it. And I think it was just very balanced politically as well.
Mm-hmm.
And he did a great job. Probably the best lecturer that I ever had.
Mm-hmm.
Really hard class, though. He said that he helps grade the L, or he helps design the LSAT.
Mm-hmm.
Really good professor, really good lectures. Harder tests, they're application-based, but just very balanced in how he presented everything, and I thought it was really good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I would... American heritage required possibly a second semester of American history / heritage. Like, you get it in high school. It's like, no, I don't care. We're still going to do more of it. Studies have shown that people decrease a lot in their knowledge of American history while they're in college. Mm-hmm. It's not, like, taught that much. And so if you're going to lose a lot of the information like the studies have shown, you can take another year of American history and we'll kind of do like a deeper dive into stuff, especially the Cold War, understanding that a little better.
I think
and
the should get
atrocities of the 20th century.
Yeah, I definitely think there should be something along the
lines. And what it means. Mm-hmm. Woodrow Wilson, the bureaucratic state, the expansion of the federal government, the expansion of the judiciary, judicial fiat, that is necessary. We'll get rid of some other GE class in there. Socratic method and practice required for all students as part of GE, and we'll knock off another GE class to keep that. Well, that doesn't have to be an entire class. Focus on Western civilization, where you actually read some original sources instead of just kind of talking about them in an overview type of way.
Yeah, Grant Madsen had a lot of original sources, like you brought out.
Yeah, we read a couple of Federalist papers mm-hmm. in my American Heritage class, and then... And I, even being an engineering major, I'd be fine. Like, no, you don't have to take college algebra again to pass like some quantitative reasoning. Or you don't need to learn. You don't need to take like Chem 105 to pass some sort of science stuff like that. I actually don't find that to be. Yeah. If you got it in high school, then I think you're fine. But this like classical logical thinking, American history, that kind of stuff, I think is the most necessary. And then no pronouns in your bio. But. See, I'm going to be a generous dictator. If you could provide me actual evidence to show that it's helpful in some strange way, and it's like solid research, not just like this wishy-washy, oh, people feel nice when that... People don't feel nice when they see your pronoun. Maybe I'm being too flippant, but like, seriously, you're like an LDS dude working at BYU, and you have him. Like, who is like, oh, thank goodness, like... When they see that, like, who's...
Now I know how to address you in my email.
When has anybody's day significantly improved after seeing pronouns in your bio? So, and it's not just that they're not useful, but it's that they're not true. Mm-hmm. It's advocating a position that's directly against one of the core tenets of the church. Mm-hmm. And we can rely on our faith to inform us that if you're doing something that goes against the truth, then it can't be helpful mm-hmm. in the end overall. But if you want to try to convince me of it, I'm open to it.
Okay.
But just like take him out or you're fired. Like I'm kind of being serious here. If I was dictator of BYU, that would happen. And then, I don't think there's that. I'd probably knock off the beard policy. Just like you can have beards, it's fine. And then I would crack down harder on the dress and grooming standards because mm-hmm. nobody ever enforces them ever. And people complain mm-hmm. about the dress and grooming standards all the time and modesty's about you and it also involves men. It's like, okay, men also have it and I don't know where you're getting this. It's about you thing from like, give me references, scriptures, conference talks, like something. I understand that your worth is not dependent on how low your shorts are or how high up your top is. But like, if you're going to go on this whole preachy soapbox thing about, it's about you and your personal relationship and other people need to deal with themselves. Like, just give me the references, give me the stats, give me something besides like your own personal opinions on it. Cause you want to wear a bikini. So anyway, that's that. I would more heavily enforce that. All right. Well, we have been here forever. So let's just get through the rest of these questions really quick, very rapid fire. And we've talked about most of them already. I love when you guys go over BYU forms. Ryan Gabriel's podcast was really good. Thank you. I think that's the answer to that one.
That wasn't really a question.
BYU policies. That, yeah, I think we talked about that. Your BYU experience. What led to this page? Hopes for America.
We've gone over that one.
Yep. Dealing with people who try and censor you for your positions and beliefs.
Oh, I just don't let them censor me.
Yeah, I don't... Yeah, I didn't.
Yeah.
No.
I think in classes, self-censorship, I think, is a real issue with.
Questions are a really great way because you can expose things and get people to think differently without even putting your neck on the line.
Yeah.
Really.
I think you can do it in a diplomatic way. Like when you ask questions in classes, be like identify the hole in the argument and then ask a question that does that basically that identifies the hole and or just flat out say, hey, this is my viewpoint, I would like to discuss this, or because usually in these classes you can get called on. I mean, in some classes I've raised my hand and after I had commented a few times and they just didn't call on me, but you should don't be afraid to express your opinion and don't be afraid to stand up for the truth, because if you don't, then who's going to, basically? Because I had, in some of my classes, I've had like 10 or so people just come up to me afterwards, say, hey, I really like when you talk in class. I feel like my views are actually getting a voice too.
Or that, okay, there's and, or a success
that,
story.
Or yeah, that's a success story. Or even people that are on the left saying, hey, I actually like when you talk in class because there's actual discussion, not just what's being talked about that mm-hmm. I believe in. And I've had that discussion with people left, right, and center, because if you're not going to do it, who's going to, basically? You have to have that. You have to take on that responsibility yourself and think that way. Because there's going to be other people who agree with you and they'll back you up sometimes,
mm-hmm.
possibly not in the, well, it depends on who it is, I guess, because not everyone's as informed as you are.
Mm-hmm.
If you're asking that type of question and if you're prepared to answer two different leftist talking points, but there's definitely people who are going to agree with you. And you have to stand up, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think once you do it, then it doesn't seem as bad.
Yeah.
And if you're nervous, the question route is, like, totally the route to go. This is the next one. Views on libertarian positions, like ending the Fed, decriminalizing drugs, etc. I do not have a strong opinion on decriminalizing drugs. Either way, I will kind of go back and forth from time to time.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, I don't have a strong opinion either direction, but that could change in a month because I'm just not that invested in that.
Yeah. My opinion would be I don't really care with drugs, except for some drugs, like if they have high negative externalities, like marijuana, go do your thing if you want to, but just don't do it on my property because I don't want to smell marijuana. Mm-hmm. I guess that's a really libertarian standpoint. Like, I don't care. Right. I don't really care what you do as long as it doesn't affect me. But something like, I think crystal meth and some like LSD, those types of things where I don't know all of the like hard drugs that cause you to be violent, that type of stuff, or
yeah,
things like that have negative externalities, I would not decriminalize. Ending the Fed, I don't have a strong opinion on it. I haven't looked into it enough to have one.
I'm libertarian in a conservative way. I'm not like super libertarian. The Book of Mormon's not really libertarian. Not that we have to have the government that the Book of Mormon had, but they use the government to uphold a lot of moral standards.
Yeah.
In the Book of Mormon.
Yeah. I think libertarianism to a degree is incorrect, but also correct. Because some things do...
It's just what extent you take it to.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, here, the question. You single?
Ah.
Yeah, nope.
Unfortunately for you, no.
Yeah.
We are both taken.
But it would have been nice to get that question before. I never got that question when I was actually single, so thank you, but it's a little late. How liberal is BYU? Overall, the students, like we said, not very much, but the liberal views are expressed very often and get a lot of traction outside of BYU.
They're a lot more prominent, and I think it has to do with that there's not a lot of pushback on it.
Yeah. We did spend a lot of time on what caused the 180-degree change in culture at BYU, how to preserve this First and Second Amendments. I don't have any specifics on that one. Not like I don't have any opinions, but I just don't think I could add anything special that nobody else has said before.
Yeah, I think culturally we have to... I mean, I'm not Elon Musk. Now he owns like 10% of Twitter, basically. But I think that we have to have more people who are willing to stand up for free speech, as well as just expressing your opinion so that it won't... So you don't feel like you have to be silenced. There's a concept known as the spiral of science in communications. Basically, if there is a chilling effect because people don't want to address something, then it just gets harder and harder and harder to address over time. And that has a negative effect on culture. That doesn't have to do with policy per se, but it has to do with just upholding cultural values. And if you don't uphold them, then they're going to get attacked.
Are liberals, are woke liberals, only going to BYU to try and challenge the culture and push their agenda? All right, so I don't know which group this person's talking about, but there are professors and then there are students. Mm-hmm. And I don't think just because you are woke necessarily means you are trying to, well, you are trying to change the culture.
But I don't think you're seeing it for this purpose.
Yeah, I don't know of anybody who only came to BYU to try and do that. Although there certainly are a number of people who kind of their primary mission, the Black Menaces are one of them, it seems like one of their primary missions right now is to change the culture at BYU towards woke stuff. And professors are kind of the same to an extent. There are a number of professors that on their Twitters or in class will just outright say things like BYU needs to change this, BYU needs to change that, usually with things like transgender policy. So, and like we put in the Kruger Chronicle, there are people that literally went to an accreditation meeting and said, BYU needs to lose its accreditation.
Why would you? As a student, that seems like you wouldn't want to say
it's
that.
It's not biting the hand that feeds you. It's like chainsawing the hand that feeds
you.
Because
then you don't.
The hand's just gone. It's not there anymore when you do that. Right. Should BYU get tithing money is the next question. We've already talked about that. And why can believers of the gospel agree with CRT? We already talked about that. Cool. We're so efficient. Look at that. It only took us 2 hours. All right. Thank you, Tommy, for coming. This was a good conversation.